Our instructor for today's presentation is Chris Boggs, Vice President of Education for the Academy of Insurance. Chris joined the insurance industry in 1990. His background includes loss control, insurance production, consulting, writing, and teaching. Over his career, Boggs has earned 9 professional insurance designations. Prior to his current duties with the Academy, Chris served as the Associate Editor of Insurance Journal's MyNewMarkets.com. During his tenure with Insurance Journal and the Academy, Chris has written and published 5 books. And without further delay, I'll turn the floor over to Chris.
Thank you, Barbara. Good afternoon or good morning, depending on where you're calling in from. I appreciate you being here today as we talk about condominiums and insuring condominiums, the associations, and even the unit owners from a property and a liability standpoint. Now, just as a sort of a shameless self-promotion, the information for this class comes from one of our books, the Wow, I Never Knew That, Chapter 15 of the book. So let's jump right into it and talk about what our agenda is for today. We're going to start by discussing and detailing the 2 main questions that are necessary to correctly construct the condominium property coverage picture. And we'll talk about it and we'll relate it sort of as a jigsaw puzzle type connection. Then we'll detail the 3 levels of associational responsibility and the 4 real property definitions relevant to condominium real property coverage. And I'll specify that a few times, and we'll define the levels of associational responsibility. Those 3 points sort of will be tied together as we go through this. Then we're going to talk about how FEMA's flood policy manages the coverage aspects of the condominium risk, and we'll talk about statutes and how they relate to associational coverage responsibility. We'll talk about values assignable to condominium property. Then we'll turn to our liability side and discussing managing the associations and the unit owners' liability exposure. And we'll end by listing what information is required to provide proper protection for the association and the unit owner. And one of the things you know is once you know what is required for one party, you know what the other party needs in this picture of property and liability exposure. So let's jump into it and let's get started. When we're writing property insurance coverage for either a condominium association or a unit owner, we have to remember that there are, to some extent, competing interests. But these interests, they're not mutually exclusive. In fact, they're complementary. As we've already said, when the interest of one party ends, the interest of another party, of the other party, begins. When the interest of the association ends, the interest of the unit owner begins from a property perspective. And as I've already said, I will say that several times as we go through this session. The problem in this is defining the point where the interest in the real property changes from the association to the unit owner and vice versa, when it goes from the unit owner to the association. So that's what we'll be spending our time today. So whether we're working with the association or the unit owner, or if we're working with the association and the unit owner, you've got to know the answer to 2 key property questions. The first one is, who is responsible for what property? Who owns what, if you will? And we'll spend most of our time in the early part of the session talking about this question, who owns what property? And as I said, this is sort of like a puzzle. We have to piece it together to ensure that and answer the question that we just asked is based on 2 key factors. The first question, or the first factor, when we're talking about who owns what, is we have to understand the meanings or descriptions of 4 real property terms that could be found in the association's covenants, conditions, and restrictions, the CCRs. So we're going to be talking about 4 real property terms that we'll define in just a few minutes. And we have to compare that and connect that to the level of associational responsibility that is spelled out in the CCRs, in the covenants, conditions, and restrictions. And there are 3 potential levels that we'll discuss as we move forward. So when we're piecing the puzzle together of who owns what, we're looking first at 4 types of real property and then what the association within its CCRs, within its governing documents, has said this is what we're responsible for and this is what you, unit owner, are responsible for. So when the real property, again, when real property is no longer the association's responsibility, it is the unit owner's responsibility. And here's the fun part. It doesn't matter who you are working with. It doesn't matter if you're working with the association or the unit owner. You've got to review the same information. So it's almost the same amount of work regardless of whether or not you're doing work for the association or for the unit owner. You've got to get the same information to make sure that you are insuring the property correctly. Our second key question is, what is the value of the insured property? What's it worth? And we're not going to be talking about valuing property today as part of this class. We're going to be talking about the different valuation requirements or the different valuation methods that you will find in the governing documents, in the CCRs, or in statute of a particular state if it's not defined in the CCR. So when we're talking about, regardless of who the insurer is, whether it's the association or the unit owner, and whatever constitutes insurable property, again, relating back to responsibility, you have to know what valuation method is required and which is being applied to the policy. Because values, which we'll see in just a few minutes, can have very different meanings based on, again, the CCRs, which generally do define the valuation method being used, and again, the statutes, if it's not defined by the CCR. And even though it might be defined, the valuation method being used might be defined by the CCR, or the statute if it has to be, but most likely in the covenants, conditions, and restrictions. Sometimes the coverage provided by the policy, the valuation method provided by the policy, is different than the governing documents. So you have to understand what valuation method is required and what is actually being used. And that will be the second question that we'll be talking about today. So we'll begin with responsibility. Who owns what? And as I mentioned, there are essentially three potential levels of associational responsibility. I want to make sure you understand that. I'm highlighting that specifically. Associational responsibility. When we're talking about these next three concepts, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about, what does the association, what does the condominium association have responsibility for insuring? And as we go through this part, keep in mind that we're focusing on real property. Now, I don't mean to be too basic, but just as a reminder, real property is land and everything attached to the land. We're talking about real property. And more specifically, we're focusing on insurable real property, because some real property is not insurable. It's specifically excluded in the policies. So let's look at these three levels of association responsibility, these three concepts. Our first level, our first concept, is what we call all in, or it can also be called all inclusive. This means that the four types of real property that we're going to be talking about in just a few minutes and are detailed in the CCRs are the association's responsibility, and they should be insured by the association. Well, again, up to what is insurable. So when we're looking at all in, is pretty simplistic. If you look at the continuum at the bottom of the screen, you'll see that the all in is the far right. It's the maximum coverage. All real property is covered by the association. It's all in, all inclusive. And again, we're going to talk about the different types of property, the four different types of property, in just a few minutes. But when we get there, just remember, when we're talking about all in, all of the property, real property we're going to be talking about, is covered by the association. All in. Then we have bare walls, which is very limited real property coverage. But the real question is, and the real question that arises out of that, how bare is bare? Bare property has no, or bare walls has no common meaning. It could mean the association is only responsible up to the studs, to the roof joists, to the floor joists. Or it could say that the association is responsible up to the unfinished drywall, which means it doesn't cover the paint. But you see some associational documents that you can consider them bare walls, they just won't cover the paint, or they won't cover the wallpaper, or they won't cover any other wall covering or floor covering. They just cover the basics, up to the joists of the floor, up to the base level of the floor, up to the unfinished wall. But there's no one definition of bare walls. So bare walls can mean different things depending on the CCRs of a particular association or even the state, if you have to drop back to statutes. And I know I keep mentioning dropping back to statutes, and we'll talk about that again later. But if the CCRs don't define something, the statutes of a particular state will. So we have all in and bare walls. Those are the opposite ends of the spectrum. All in means the association is responsible for all real property. Bare walls could mean different things, but it is the least amount of protection or the least amount of responsibility placed on the association. Then we have you might consider a middle ground, although it's closer to the all-in side. We have the original specifications. The association responsibility is original specifications. We also call this single entity coverage. As I said, this is sort of the middle ground between all-in and bare walls, but closer to the all-in side. The association is responsible for all real property that existed when the building was originally constructed, thus the term original specifications. So the association is only responsible for putting back what was there when the building was built. If the unit owner has made upgrades to the real property, they've taken out the old counters and put in new counters, or they've taken out the old cabinets and put in new cabinets, or they've done a whole lot of updates that have improved it, the association is not responsible for that property. They're responsible for ensuring what was there when it was built. So again, all in includes everything, including those tenants' improvements and betterments. Those unit owners' improvements and betterments. Original specification is only responsible for putting back what was there when the building was originally constructed. So we have all in, everything. Bare walls is as minimum as it's going to get, but there's no one definition of how minimum that might be. And original specs. Original specifications, you're putting back what was there when it was built. And we're going to combine these three concepts with the four condo-specific definitions of real property. And when we do, we'll get a much clearer picture of who's responsible for what property. And then we can do a better job of snapping this who owns what picture together. So, as I said, I keep referring to the four condo-specific definitions of real property. We're going to take a look at them on the next few slides here. Then we'll combine the levels of association responsibility that we just talked about, the all-in, bare walls, and original specifications, with these definitions of property, the condo-specific definitions of real property, to see who owns and ultimately insures which property. And these definitions are found in one of two places. They're either found in the CCRs, and I've said this 48 times already, or in the relevant state statute if they're not addressed in the CCR, in the association's own documents. Our four definitions, or our four types of real property that we're going to be looking at, are common elements, limited common elements, unit property, and unit improvements and betterments. So let's talk about common elements. And you've got pictures here in your slides to sort of give you an idea of what we're talking about when we're talking about common elements. Now, common elements are real property owned by and beneficial to all members of the association, or a very large majority of the members of the association. It includes land and parking lots, which may not be insurable. And it can sometimes include foundations and load-bearing walls. And the reason why I say it says sometimes includes foundations and load-bearing walls is based on the number of buildings you have. If you have more than one building, then you're going to have a situation where the foundation and load-bearing walls don't serve all members of the association. They only serve a certain amount, a certain percentage of the association. The term common elements also includes clubhouses, pool houses, pools, fences, gates, playground equipment, tennis courts, and any other real property owned by the association and allocated to all unit owners. And we're talking about common elements. Generally, the definition of common elements does specifically exclude unit property, which we'll define in just a couple of minutes. So common elements, it's beneficial to, it's assigned to all or a large majority of the unit owners. So we have common elements. Then we have limited common elements. And limited common elements are sort of like common elements, but they're a real property element beneficial to or affecting more than one, but less than all unit owners. This, again, could include structural foundations and load-bearing walls, like we just talked about, when there's more than one buildings. And there's several other examples of limited common elements, such as common hallways or corridors that provide access to several units, walls or columns containing electrical wiring, sprinkler piping or plenum enclosures, ductwork, servicing or protecting several units. But the interesting thing about limited common elements is sometimes there are elements that we call limited common elements that only apply to or are only beneficial to one unit owner. And this includes doorsteps, stoops, decks, porches, balconies, patios, exterior doors, and windows. And again, even though they only serve a single unit, they're located outside of what we call the unit boundary, which is a defined term that we'll define in just a few minutes. But because they're outside the unit boundary, they become an association responsibility as a limited common element because their appearance matters to everybody. If you have a deck that's falling apart, even though it only benefits that one unit owner, it makes the whole association look bad. If you've got a door that's falling apart or falling off the hinges, although that's only benefiting one unit owner, it looks bad for the whole association. So even though it's a unit owner specific element, doorsteps, balconies, decks, like we just talked about, it's still considered a limited common element and an association responsibility. Then we have what's called unit property. And unit property is a function of a term called unit boundary. And unit boundaries, the boundaries of a specific unit are generally defined in the CCRs, in the governing documents of the association. Unit property, this property benefits only the unit owner. And most commonly, when we think about unit property, if you look at the pictures here, what we're looking at is the inside of the exterior unit walls, interior partition walls, the walls between the living room and the bedroom, or the living room and the kitchen, or whatever. So the interior partition walls are non-load-bearing walls. They're only benefiting the unit owners. Countertops, cabinetry, plumbing fixtures, any other real property that is confined to that unit and benefits only that unit owner. That is unit property. Remember, we're talking about unit real property. We're not talking about their personal property. We're not talking about their couches and TVs and chairs and everything else. We're talking about unit real property. It benefits none but the unit owner and is completely within the unit boundary. But as I mentioned before, with the bare wall situation, just like bare walls doesn't have a universal definition, because it doesn't have a universal definition, neither does the definition of what qualifies as a unit boundary. Everything within the unit boundary is unit property. But the problem again is there's no one definition of unit boundary. You have to review the CCRs, the declarations of the association, in order to discover what actually qualifies as a unit boundary so that you can go back and find out what qualifies as unit property. And here's a couple of examples that I wanted to put up for you so that you can see how fun it is to try to figure out what the definition of a unit boundary is so that you can define what unit property is. I've given you two examples of unit property definitions. The one on the left is taken from the Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act of 2008, the most recent version, and the one on the right is taken from an actual association's CCR. These are extremely fun to read. Look at number one on the description on the left. Unit boundaries, except as provided by the declarations. So if the association's document says something different, the association's document takes precedence. But this is what the Uniform Act says. If walls, floors, or ceilings are designed, designated as boundaries of a unit, all lath, furring, wallboard, plasterboard, plaster, paneling, tiles, wallboard, paint, finished flooring, and any other materials constituting any part of the finished surfaces thereof are part of the unit. And all other portions of the wall, floors, or ceilings are part of the common elements. Fun to read, isn't it? Basically, if you want to break that down, the association is responsible, the unit is from the studs in. The association ends at the stud, and the unit owner begins from the studs in. Subject, come down to number three at the bottom, below that. Subject to paragraph two, all spaces, interior partitions, and other fixtures and improvements within the boundaries of a unit are part of the unit. Don't you just love reading these? Well, look at the one that comes from an actual association. You'll love this one. Under definition of unit boundaries, the boundaries of each unit are as follows. Upper and lower horizontal boundaries. Upper and lower horizontal boundaries means the roof and the floor. The upper and lower boundaries of the unit are the following boundaries extended to an intersection with a vertical, parametric, boundaries. I don't want to read all this to you, but this is fun. The upper boundary, the horizontal plane of the bottom surface of the wood joist of the ceiling, except where there is a drop ceiling, in which location of the upper boundary is a horizontal plane, which includes the top of the surface, yada, yada, yada. Do you see why you're going to have to get a lawyer involved sometimes? Now, if you look at these two descriptions of unit property side by side, they might actually be saying the same thing, except when you start talking about parametric boundaries and the upper boundaries, except when you have a drop ceiling and all this other good stuff. Every now and then, you're going to have to get an attorney involved to discuss and define what exactly is the definition of unit boundaries, so that you can come up with what unit property is, depending, again, based on what the association's responsibility is. The majority of the time, and I hesitate to say this, many times the definition of unit boundary is going to be from the studs in, but that doesn't mean that the association is only responsible for the studs. It just means that the unit owner owns all the studs in, but the association might actually be responsible for everything under the all-in circumstance. So let's talk about that as we, but let's finish up our definitions of associational property. We had common elements, limited common elements. We just discussed unit property. So let's come back to our last one, unit improvements and betterments. It's just what it sounds like. Again, this units, improvements, and betterments are included within this, within the broad scope of unit property, because it's within the unit. It's benefiting only the unit owner. But we have to separate it out because of our different definitions of our different levels of association responsibility. So we have to separate it out for coverage purposes. So simply, unit improvements and betterments is created when the unit owner upgrades the unit, when they upgrade it from what it was when it was built, original specifications, and put something new in. They go from carpet to hardwood. They go from laminate to a granite countertop. They upgrade the cabinets. Do whatever they can. They upgrade it. They do something and make it different than when it was originally built. So they've upgraded. They've done improvements and betterments to the unit. And again, these improvements and betterments benefit only the unit owner. So it's, like I said, it's sort of a subclass of unit property, but it has to be broken out specifically because of the different levels of association responsibility. So let's piece this together. Now that we understand the three different types or three different levels of association responsibility and the four different types of property, we can piece these together now and talk about who is responsible for what. We'll define the levels of associational responsibility and the unit owners, what they're responsible for insuring. So if the association has an all-in responsibility, their CCRs, their declarations say that the association is responsible for insuring all real property. It won't say it that basically, but that's sort of what you're going to have to read into it, that they're going to cover. The association has chosen to insure all real property. So the association is on an all-in responsibility basis. So the association in that case is responsible for insuring the common elements, the limited common elements, unit property, and unit improvements and betterments. Again, all real property is the responsibility of the association. Now granted, you'll see the all-in level, the all-in responsibility level from time to time. It's not the most common. I actually think original specs might be the most common, but you will see it from time to time. And when you do, you now understand that all real property is the association's responsibility. Let's go to the other end of the spectrum. All-in means everything is the association's responsibility. Bare walls, remember we talked about the fact that bare walls is the other end of the spectrum, which is the least amount of responsibility is placed on the association. The association in a bare wall situation is responsible for insuring the common elements and limited common elements. The unit owner insures unit property, unit improvements and betterments, and their own personal property. And again, the problem is there is no universal definition of unit property. So we've got to get back because of the definition, the lack of a specific or a standard definition of unit boundaries. So we're back to having to read the CCRs, regardless of who you're insuring. If you're insuring the association or the unit owner, you've got to know who's responsible for what. Is it all in? The association insures everything, all real property. The unit owner insures their personal property, their stuff. That's all they're responsible for. Bare walls, sort of split half and half. Well, for that unit owner. The association has common elements, limited common elements, and the unit owner has responsibility for all unit-specific property, unit property and unit improvements and betterments, and their personal property. Then we have original specifications. Again, that's called single entity coverage. And if we remember, original specifications means the association is only responsible for putting back, for insuring what was there. So the association insures the common elements, the limited common elements, and the unit property that was there in the beginning, carpet versus hardwood, laminate versus granite, whatever the situation is, the association is responsible for insuring what was there, but not within the unit, but not the upgrades that have been made by the unit owner. So the association even has unit property, but the unit owner is responsible for insuring unit improvements and betterments and their personal property within the unit. So why does all this matter? Well, it matters because of limits of coverage and deciding how much coverage does the unit owner need. And we'll talk about limits again in just a little bit, but it's a matter of how much coverage does the unit owner need. Do they need to buy more than what's given in the policy? Or are they good with that? And if you don't ask the right questions and if you don't know what to look for in the CCRs and the governing documents, you might not give them enough coverage, which creates all kinds of situations at the time of a loss, if there is one. But I've said this several times. I'm going to make this major does statement again. You'll notice that if the association isn't responsible for insuring it, the unit owner is. Like I said, I realize that's a major duh statement, but not really, because even if the association is responsible for insuring a particular type of real property, what happens, and you'll see this a lot, what happens if the association has a large deductible and they assess owners, the unit owners, after the claim occurs to recover that lost deductible? The unit owner's coverage forms, the HO6 on the ISO side, and AAIS has an HO6 and also a Form 6. The unit owner's forms do have loss assessment coverage. The ISO unendorsed form gives you $1,000 for assessments, and the AAIS form gives you $1,500 for assessments, both on a per loss basis. So if you're writing the unit owner, you want to make sure that the unit owner doesn't end up with a big assessment bill because of the high association deductible. So you've got to find out what the association's deductible is. So again, even if you're only writing the unit owner of a condominium association, you still have a lot of work to do. You have to find out what the association is responsible for, which leads you to what the unit owner is responsible for. Then you've got to make sure you've got the correct coverage for the unit owner for the real property they're responsible for. Then you've got to know that even if the association is responsible, the unit owner could be hit with an assessment bill if in a loss situation. So you have to find out what the association deductible is, and to try, there's not necessarily going to be an easy way to do this, and try to determine how much the owner, the unit owner, may be required to pay if there is a loss and an assessment. Now, the association might choose one of several ways to assess each unit owner. They may divide it equally among all unit owners, or they might do it based on square footage, or it might be based on the type of property that was damaged. If it's a multiple building, they may only assess the owners of that one building. So there's many different ways that it might be divided up depending on the law situation, and you're going to have to find out what's the worst case scenario for your insured, for your unit owner. Because if that $1,000 provided by ISO isn't enough, and the $1,500 provided by AAIS, if you're writing under the AAIS homeowners form, isn't enough, you're going to have to endorse the policy to increase the assessment limit. But if you're writing a homeowner's using the ISO form, hopefully they're using the 2011 edition of the form, because if they're using the 2010 version of the form, you can't increase the assessment coverage. It's still $1,000. You cannot increase it for assessment for a deductible of the association. Let me say that again specifically. You can't increase that $1,000 limit in the 2010 version of the form for an associational deductible assessment. If you have the 11 form, you can. All right. So that's our associational level responsibility. But how does an NFIP flood insurance form respond to associational responsibility? We have to first understand, before I answer that question, that there are two flood forms that are going to combine to cover the association and the unit owner. The association is going to hopefully have a residential condominium building association policy, an RCBAP, and the unit owner is going to use the dwelling form to cover their stuff. But as we're looking at this, there's actually a special RCBAP rule that controls which form is wholly responsible for the real property. The Residential Condominium Building Association Policy, FEMA Rule 4A property coverage states this: the entire building. That's pretty plain. The entire building is covered under one policy, including both the common as well as the individually owned building elements, the unit property. Within the units, improvements within the units, units improvements and tenants and owners improvements and betterments, and contents owned in common. Contents owned by the individual unit owner should be insured under an individual unit owner's dwelling form. You see what this says? I don't care what the associational documents say. I don't care what it says the association responsibility is, all in, bare walls, original specs. If you write an RCBAP, it's an all-in form, period. You don't have a choice in this. So even though you might have a condominium that is a bare walls, or the association only has a bare walls requirement under the commercial property form, if you're writing the RCBAP, it's all-in. So you may actually have different limits between the two forms, depending on the amount of coverage, that the values of the buildings. So you might have different limits because you're writing one on a bare walls basis, but the RCBAP is on an all-in basis, and you have no option on that. You can't say to FEMA, oh, we're just going to cover the limit common elements and limited common elements. No, they tell you in the rules, we are covering the entire building. But here's the issue. They're covering the entire building. Now, the RCBAP is written on a replacement cost basis, but it has limits. It's limited to $250,000 per unit. And if that's not enough, you may have to buy excess coverage, and it only applies if it's in a regular program. So flood is all-in coverage, regardless of what the CCR say. There's no option. So the commercial property coverage and the flood policy may cover different property, as if we didn't have enough fund after a flood and wind type of loss. And the dwelling form is going to cover the contents only for the unit owner. So again, regardless of what the association responsibility says in the CCRs, all in, bare walls, original specs, by flood policy on an RCBAP, it's all in. You need to remember that. So statutes are what we call, I've mentioned several times, either you find it in the CCRs or the statutes. Well, the statutes are the default setting regarding who owns what property and even valuation method to some extent. If the associational documents don't say anything, statute jumps in and takes over. The associational documents, the CCRs, take precedence over the statute. And in fact, the statute specifically says that. It says, except as provided by the declarations, by the CCRs. And the reason why the statutes are secondary, the reason why the CCRs take precedent, is because they supposedly, and I use that term purposely, the CCR supposedly represent the desires of the majority of the unit owners within that association. But the problem with that belief is that most CCRs probably have not been reviewed or updated since they were originally written by the developer. They may not meet the desires of the current members of the association. That a lot of times you'll see associational documents that haven't been updated since the condominium was built, or they might have been updated one time 15 years ago. So they don't necessarily represent everybody's opinion anymore, but they still take precedent over statute. So in unit ownership situations, statutes defining association responsibility apply only if these duties are not defined in the associational documents. Many states, I've given you this list of all the statutes that we can find, many states in the statutes as it relates to who owns what follow the Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act, which can be interpreted as an original specifications responsibility, which means the association is responsible for putting back what was there when it was built. All ends, everything. Bare walls is differing definitions depending on the association. Original specs means the association is responsible for putting back what was there when it was built. When you read the statutes, a majority of the states, about 30, can be read as original specifications. About 15 can be interpreted as all in, saying that the association is going to cover all real property, all four types: common elements, limited common elements, unit property, and unit improvements and betterments. And about 13 state statutes can be viewed as bare walls. Again, at varying levels of what constitutes bare walls. Now, I know that adds up to more than 50, but there are some state statutes that can be interpreted in more than one way. So, again, in situations where you can't get a good, clear opinion, a legal opinion might be required. As a matter of fact, depending on who you're insuring, I would recommend one highly, getting a legal opinion of who's responsible for what property, if there's any doubt, if it's not crystal clear. But even when you go to get a legal opinion, it might not give you the answer that you're after, or it might give you an incorrect answer. I was involved a few years ago with a condominium association who was having a loss problem, a loss settlement problem in Mississippi. They were in Mississippi, and they were damaged by Hurricane Katrina. And they actually had two lawyers' opinions. One lawyer read the specifications, read the document as original specifications. The other lawyer read it as bare walls. So even when the attorneys get involved, they don't always give you the answer, the correct answer, or even the same answer. But all you can do is all you can do. But remember, you've got to do the same and gather the same information regardless of which party you're dealing with, the association or the unit owner. So let's move now to our second question of this puzzle. What's it worth? How much insurance should be carried? Now, again, we're not going to talk about how to value the property. We're going to talk about the different values that could be assigned to a property based on the documents being used. So the answer depends on the defined values. How much protection is the association required to carry? How much protection is the association required to carry? Either found in and defined in the CCRs or in the statutes or the policy form that they're in. So the Uniform Common Interest Act of 2008 recommends using actual cash value. And most state statutes use actual cash value as well as the minimum, and I'm highlighting that on purpose, the minimum amount of coverage that should be carried, the actual cash value of the building. Now, actual cash value is defined as cost new at the time of the loss, not when the policy was written, not when the buildings were built, cost new at the time of the loss minus less physical depreciation. So most statutes and a lot of CCRs that you see might say the association has to carry at least actual cash value. Some say replacement cost. Now, replacement cost is the cost to replace with new materials of like kind and quality. But it does not. You've got to be very careful with replacement cost. And I always recommend insuring at replacement cost, even if the association says using actual cash value. Because you can always do more than the documents. You just can't do less than the documents. But replacement cost is cost to replace with like kind and quality, new materials with like kind and quality. But again, it's not necessarily new for old. And we have to be real careful when we explain replacement cost. Unfortunately, we don't have time to go into that long discussion today, but it's a more in-depth discussion than we have with a lot of insurers because you might have ordinance or law issues and some other things that may not allow for replacement cost. Then you'll see some CCRs. I've seen CCRs that say this. I've seen some state statutes related to condominiums that use market value. Now, market value creates a problem for us, because market value is not normally an insurance terminology as it relates to valuing property. Market value is a willing buyer and a willing seller. What will a willing buyer pay a willing seller for the property? Again, that's not generally an insurance valuation. Market value can fluctuate up and down. So if you see a CCR, think about it. In 2006, before everything crashed in 2008, 2009, the market value of a building, of a condominium associational building, might have been $1 million. In 2008, 2009, it might have been $600,000. That doesn't change what it costs to rebuild the property. That's market value. That's a willing buyer and a willing seller. So if you see that valuation method being used by an association, you might not be able to change their mind, but you might want to get clarification from them and say, hey, I see that it says market value, and explain to them what that means. Explain to them why that's not an insurance value normally. We don't generally deal in a market value situation. We come to insurance. We want to know what it's going to cost to put the building back and explain to them what your concerns are. You might not get them to change it. They may not change it. But explain the problem this causes, because market value fluctuates. It could be higher. It could be lower than what it actually costs to rebuild the structure. But like I said, I always recommend using replacement costs. Regardless of what the CCR say, I recommend, and I can't tell you what to do, I'm just talking from a recommendation standpoint, using replacement costs, because that avoids all kinds of problems. You can always do more than the CCR or the statute. You just can't do less. So you have to develop the values. You've got to use cost estimators. You want to talk to knowledgeable builders in the area. Get a real estate appraiser as well, especially if you're dealing with market value side of the stuff, which we really don't want to play with, but it might help to know what the market value of a building is. But I recommend replacement costs. So that's what we're looking at, and that's what we're dealing with as it relates to valuing these buildings and the valuation methods that may be applied. So you might see CCRs that say you got insured ACV. You might see some that say replacement cost, which is great to some extent. And you might see some that say, hey, market value. Then you got to express your concerns. So what property value problems can be based on association responsibility types? If we have an all-in association responsibility, remember, all-in is the association is responsible for all real property, common elements, limited common elements, unit property, and unit improvements and betterments. Excuse me. This could be difficult for the association and the agent, because the association and the agent doesn't know what has been updated and the values involved in those changes. Thus, if it's an all-in situation, that could be a major co-insurance problem for the insured, for the association. The association is responsible for insuring all the real property. Well, half of the association members have made changes and upgraded and improved the real property. They've gone from carpet to hardwoods, linoleum to granite, or whatever the situation is, so they have all this new stuff, and the association may not know about it. Now, some CCRs do require unit owners to notify the association of any changes or upgrades within a certain amount of time. But the requirement may not be known by the unit owner, or if it is, they might just forget to do it, or the association may not enforce it. The owner may simply, again, forget and not do it, or the unit owner may not know what to do with the information. Or they may give it to the person who's on the board, and that person on the board might say, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this, and they just forget about it and throw it away. So the association doesn't really know what is there. And if that's the case, and a lot of the unit owners make changes and upgrades to their unit, and the association hasn't kept up with the valuations of those buildings, you can see how all-in can create a co-insurance potential issue, a valuation issue, because they haven't kept up with it. A good risk management practice for an association might be a regular, I don't know if it needs to be annual or every other year or whatever you decide, asking the association, asking all the unit owners, have you made any changes to your unit? Have you upgraded your unit in any way? Yes, no, or maybe. Yes, and describe those additions and values and all that good stuff so the association can keep up with what has occurred, so that there's not a valuation problem at the time of a loss. Bare walls. Now, bare walls seems like it would be a little bit easier, but that can also create a conflict, especially if the unit owner does not have enough coverage or other money to repair the property for which he's responsible. So My unit's damaged or destroyed, and I don't have enough coverage. My responsibility as on a bare walls basis, I was supposed to insure unit property and unit improvements and betterments, but I depended on the amount of coverage that came from that came in the policy. So I've only got $5,000 worth of dwelling coverage, and I've got a $40,000 loss. Well, I don't happen to carry $35,000 with me, so I can't repair it. So it sits there unrepaired. What does that do to the association, to the values of the surrounding buildings, that unit can't be fixed? It's an end unit or a middle unit. So you got the situation. So we have to make sure that the unit owners carry the right amount of coverage, because we have to decipher the definition of unit. What is the unit owner responsible for insuring? Then we have to ensure that they're carrying the correct amount of coverage for the property they are responsible for insuring. But a problem it creates for the association is, how do you accurately subtract out the value of unit property, including the unit improvements and betterments? You've got a $1 million building on an all-in basis. Well, tell me what the value of each unit is to deduct from that, because that's the unit owner's responsibility. No fun and games in that. Now, a builder may be able to tell you, maybe able to give you a pretty good estimate, but you see, that's sort of problematic. And so what's the answer for the association from the unit owner standpoint is, they want to make sure the unit owner carries enough coverage. So maybe the recommendation to the association is, hey, you define and you describe to every unit owner what they're responsible for, make an estimation of what the value of that is, and say, at minimum, you insure this. Now, that could be dangerous, I realize. And you as an agent on the carrier side probably should not do that. But it might be a recommendation you make to them to come up with their own system for making sure that there's no gap in coverage between the association and the unit owners. The unit is going to be rebuilt, and nobody's going to be hit hard with out-of-pocket expense. Original specifications. Now, this might be the easiest to develop, because remember, with original specifications, the association is responsible for what? They're responsible for putting back the building as it was when it was built originally. So that might be the easiest to develop a valuation, because there may be the plans hopefully exist someplace, and you can say, okay, the building today, we take it to a builder and say, how much would it cost us to build this building today? And you insure it at that. But remember, if it's an older building, make sure that you consider the ordinance or law issue, the building code issues, and include that value and include that coverage in the policy itself, and endorse the policy to make sure you have building code coverage, ordinance or law coverage. So that may be the easiest. All in, you could have the gap in the fact that you don't know what everybody's done. Bare walls, you probably will end up over-insuring, which is okay to some extent, but your bigger problem there is the fact that the unit owner may not properly insure. So you've got to make sure the unit owner is insuring everything they're responsible for if the association responsibility is on a bare walls basis. Original specs, probably the easiest of the three. You just need to go find out what it would take to put back what was there when it was built. Plus, you've got to insure the ordinance or law issue, the building code issue. And again, don't forget about the unit owner's assessment issue here that we talked about just a few minutes ago. So let's now move away from property and talk very briefly about the association and unit owner's liability exposure. Now, liability exposure is based on the concept of legal liability. And legal liability is defined as liability imposed by the courts or statute on any person or entity responsible for injury to or damage suffered by another party. And legal obligation can arise from intentional acts, unintentional acts, or contracts. Now, I realize not all of those are insurable, but that's within the definition of what legal liability is. Now, legal liability, keep this in mind and remember this, legal liability is not the same as being negligent. You can actually be negligent without being legally liable, because you could be negligent, but you still have to, the injured party still has to prove damages. They have to prove that the negligent act was the cause in fact, and that there was no superseding event. So you could be negligent but not be held legally ultimately be held legally liable. It's the beginning, but it doesn't mean just because you were negligent you'll be held legally liable. And there are also situations when you can be held legally liable without actually being negligent. It's called vicarious liability. Parent, child, employee, employer, employee. As the parent, I'm responsible for the actions of my children. Now, I may not have done the act, But if they did, I'm responsible for it. As the employer, my employee may have committed the act. I, as the employer, didn't do it, but the employee did. So I am vicariously responsible for the actions of that person. So associations and unit owners are what we call mutual beneficiaries because they essentially occupy the same space. And so what we're going to do real quick is we're going to look at some of the possibilities and issues that could be created in a liability law situation. And these are if questions. If liability is placed solely on the association, so the association is found to be the one that's legally liable, not the unit owner. The unit owner has nothing to do with it. It's solely the association. Liability is placed solely on the association. We're going back to our assessment situation. Now, on the property side, we had assessment for property losses, but on the liability side, we also have the potential for assessments if the association buys a liability policy with a self-insured retention or a high deductible on the general liability side. So the association may assess the unit owners when there is that deductible or self-insured retention on the CGL. Now, ISO, again, gives you $1,000 for assessment, which you can increase by endorsement if you're using the 2011 edition of the form, the HO0435. The AAIS form gives you $1,500 for associational assessment from a liability loss that you cannot increase. So if the unit owner is being written on the AAIS form, $1,500 is all you get for a liability assessment. On the ISO side, it's $1,000, but you can increase it by endorsement under the most current version of the homeowner's form. So if liability is placed on the association, the potential problem is for the unit owner. And obviously, the potential problem for the association is do they have enough coverage? But the problem for the unit owner potentially is they could potentially be assessed if there's a deductible or something along those lines. Now, if liability is placed solely on the unit owner, our problem is limits. How much coverage was purchased by the unit owner? Do they have $100,000 worth of coverage? Do they have $1,000,000? Do they have an umbrella? So the association may not have an issue because it may be completely the unit owner's. And even if the unit owner is named as an additional insured, the additional insured endorsement on the liability side, the ISO endorsement wording says, but it doesn't provide additional insured status for the unit owner in their own space. So if it's a unit owner issue, the problem for the unit owner is do they have enough coverage? So does the association care if the unit owner has enough liability coverage? Is it the association's responsibility to care? I don't know. Should the association say, hey, unit owner, you've got to have at least $1,000,000? Should that be in the declarations? I don't know. That's up to the association. But that's something that has to be considered for you as the agent if you're writing the unit owner, is to make sure that and realize that they could be held responsible for some of their own actions. Do they have enough coverage, just like on the homeowner side? Now, what if they're jointly liable? What if it's the unit owner and the association are jointly liable? How's the association going to manage this? Are they going to require higher limits of the unit owner? Because the question is going to come down to some extent, how much liability is assigned to each party? And there could be a limits cap situation. The unit owner might have $300,000 worth of coverage, where the association might have $1,000,000 plus an umbrella. So there could be a limits gaps. And how does the state apply the concept of joint and several liability? Now, joint liability means that any one tortfeasor, any one wrongdoer can be held financially responsible for the entire loss. Any one wrongdoer can be held responsible for the entire loss. If it's several, it means each party is responsible only for its share of the fault, which is translated into money, which means the liability can be severed. Joint and several. Joint and, if you wish, severed liability. It's severed. It's cut between the two parties. 9 states apply pure joint and several. So each defendant is responsible or can be responsible for the entire amount of the loss to make sure that the injured party is fully compensated. 27 states use modified joint and several. One tortfeasor is potentially responsible for the entire amount, but only if they're liable beyond a specific amount. And some states bar recovery if the injured party is at fault beyond a certain percentage. sort of like contributory negligence. And 14 states use pure several. Each party shares the cost based on the percentage of fault. So if I'm 20% at fault and the association is 80% at fault and it's $1 million, I got to come up with $200,000. And basically it assures that the at-fault parties are held responsible, are not held responsible for more than their own actions. So when you got a joint and several situation, I could potentially be held, or the association could potentially be held responsible for more than their part in it, more than their level of fault, if you will, because they got bigger pockets. In pure several situations, you're not held responsible beyond the level of your actions, beyond the assignability of your actions, if you will. So who's going to be held responsible? How do we assign liability? So the one key question is where did the injury occur? And this points to most likely who will most likely be held legally liable. And remember the definitions of each of these property types. When you got common elements, liability is most likely going to be assigned solely to the association. Not always. It's going to depend on the facts of the situation, on the facts of the case. But if the injury occurs on a common element, it's probably going to be the association's responsibility, subject to the unit owner throwing the guy down or doing whatever the situation may be. But if it's just they're out playing ball or something else, the association, they're visiting and they fall in a hole, and it's on common element situation, probably going to be the association. And the unit owners are generally additional insureds on the CGL for liability arising out of any portion of the premises not reserved for the unit owner's exclusive use or occupancy. Now, on a limited common element, that's a little different. Remember, limited common elements can include property that serves just one unit owner, but is an element that is the responsibility of the association. Again, it's sort of like when it comes with assigning liability, it's somewhat the same as common elements, but there are those gray areas that we just talked about. Again, those elements that are considered limited common elements serving only one unit owner: stairs, stoops, balconies, decks. The association is generally responsible for the maintenance and upkeep that type of property. Again, they serve one unit, but they're outside the unit boundaries, which makes them the requirement of the association to keep up and maintain them. So the question is going to come down to what caused the injury. Was it a situation where someone was walking from the deck into the unit and the unit owner patted them on the back and pushed them in, they fell in and broke their nose? That's going to be a unit owner situation. But what if the balcony collapses, like occurred earlier this year in California, because of wood rot? That's the association's responsibility. So the limited common element situation is going to be, what are the facts of the injury? Did the association not keep up and maintain the property that they should have, or did the unit owner in some way cause the injury? Now, unit property, if the injury occurs on the unit property, likely it's the unit owner's problem, and their homeowner's policy is going to have to pay, which is back to making sure we have the correct amount, or the not the correct amount, but sufficient amount of liability limits to cover that situation. Now, I've always got to put this disclaimer when I talk about liability limits, assigning liability. This is not legal advice, and things change based on the specifics of the situation. This is just generalities, so we can't call this legal advice. So let's complete this picture. Let's tie this picture together. And again, it doesn't matter if you're writing the association or the unit owner. You've got to get all the same information together and piece it together like a puzzle to make sure that you have the coverage correct for the association and the unit owner based on who's responsible for what property and the valuation methods and everything we've just talked about. So what do you have to have? You have to have a copy, again, regardless of who you're insuring, a copy of the association's declarations or covenants, conditions, and restrictions, their CCRs. You want to have a copy of the applicable state statute. I've given you a list of all the state statutes. If possible, or if available, an official letter documenting the definition of a unit's boundaries detailing who is responsible for insuring which property. If you can get it, I would... If it's available, I would definitely, if it's not available, I would recommend they get you one. because it's going to avoid a whole lot of headaches based on who's responsible for what property at the time of a loss and making sure that everybody has the correct amount of coverage when something bad happens. A verifiable or signed property valuation calculation. Because remember, we want to make sure we're insuring it correctly, especially depending on what the association is responsible for. If the association is responsible for all in, you want to make sure that you have collected all the information about what the value of the entire building is, including improvements and betterments that are part of the building. So you want to get a signed property valuation calculation. Again, you may want to have the association ask on a regular basis, have there been any updates, and keep track of those values. And the last thing that's not on this list is you also need to know or have a good estimate of the unit owner's assessment exposure, both from a property side and a liability side, to make sure you get that coverage done correctly. Now, with that, I'll call it in today. These are some of the books that we've written. This is my contact information. Feel free to contact me after the class. Best way to get me is my email address, cboggs@ijacademy.com. cboggs@ijacademy.com. I promise you, I will get back to you as soon as possible. And with that, I appreciate your time. I apologize that we went over by a few minutes here. I'm going to turn this over to Barbara.
Perfect. If you have any questions for Chris, please go ahead and type them in the questions box or the chat box. There were a couple questions that came through during the webinar. The first one is, with original specifications, if the owner paid the developer to make upgrades, are those covered by the association since it was built with the upgrades?
That's an excellent question. My opinion is if you paid the builder, there should have been a change request. And again, you're going to have to check the specifics of the situation, but there should be a change request or something in the documentation of the plans that those changes were made at the time it was constructed. So my opinion would be, yes, those will be part of the original specifications, and that's how I believe it will be viewed. There are always differences, but that's how I think it will be viewed, simply because the changes, it should have been through a change request with the builder. So it should be documented someplace.
The next question is a little similar, but I think it's on improvements. Under the original specifications, the association is responsible for the unit as it was built. When a unit owner improves their unit, are they responsible for the total value of the improvement or the difference between the original construction and the improvement?
Sort of. Maybe I'm misunderstanding the question. The unit improvements and betterments, if the association is responsible on original specs, they're responsible, and let's say the unit under original specs would cost $20 to put back like it was, but with the new valuation, with the new materials, now the interior unit real property is worth $30,000. The unit owner is responsible for the $10,000, the difference between what the association is going to put back and what the upgrades are. I hope that answers the question.
Perfect. If you have any other questions, please type them in the chat box or the question box. Another question just came through.
Go ahead.
Okay. How should a commercial broker best approach an association in which many unit owners don't have HO6 policies and there are a lot of water losses? This is a high-rise condo.
Oh. Please don't take offense at this answer. Sometimes the aroma of the premium outweighs the stench of the risk. You may not want that situation because the association, in order to maintain a viable association, will be fixing a lot of things they shouldn't be fixing. There should be a requirement, and it might be too late to do anything for somebody who's already there, but it should be a requirement that an HO6 exist. And you can require that, just like a mortgage company can require you to have a homeowner's policy. But it's for the common good of the association. Or the association can take it on an all-in basis and just assess everybody for the difference in premium or something along those lines. But if the association can take it to an all-in basis and take all the responsibility off any unit owner to cover real property damage. Because remember, we're only talking about real property here. If they're unwilling or cannot make the unit owners cover their own, that might be the only way they can accomplish that.
Another question here. I imagine if you target both the association and the insurer target the individual unit owners as well, you better make sure to have all your ducks in a row to make sure there are no gaps in coverage limits needed. From an E&O standpoint, do you recommend against going after both the association and the unit owners?
Actually, I think from an E&O standpoint, you might be better off to have them both because, again, you've already gone through all the trouble of getting all the associational documents. If you're doing the association, you've already gone through all the trouble to get all the associational documents, and thus you are better able to serve the unit owners. On the other side, if you are serving just the unit owners, you've done just as much work, hopefully, to do it right, so go after the association. So from an E&O perspective, as long as you've done what's defendable and what's prudent in the specific situation, I don't think it's going to matter. My preference would be to have everybody. If I could, obviously, because you're doing the same amount of work. If you write one unit owner, you've done the same amount of work as if you've written the association to do it right. So from an E&O perspective, I really don't know that it's going to be one way or the other. Sort of neutral, but I would rather have both, personally.
If you have any other questions for Chris, please type them in the chat box or the questions box.
And again, as I said, if you email me, I will get back to you as soon as possible. I promise you I'll do that.
Another question just came through. Is there any reason why a unit owner should buy flood insurance?
Yeah, the possibility of being flooded. It's really the only reason. Or if there's a loan and the mortgagee makes them get it. Now, I'm assuming you're talking about somebody who's on a fourth or fifth floor. Whether or not it's needed might be irrelevant based on the loan, but we've seen some weird things. I'm here in North Carolina. We've just in South Carolina just saw some weird flooding that they hadn't seen in hundreds of years. So I'm not going to say no, you shouldn't buy it, but it may not be necessary. So I can't really answer the question with a definitive yes or no. If the mortgage company says you got to do it, you got to do it. If it seems unreasonable and you don't have to do it, don't do it. But that's a call you got to let the unit owner make. You can't make that for them.
Okay, I don't see any other questions coming through. So with that, we will end the webinar. Thank you, Chris, for your time and all the great information. And thank you, everyone, for joining us today, and we look forward to hosting you again soon.